The teacher, Parker Palmer, calls the place where we begin muttering miserable, unrepeatable things at the radio, or perhaps the social media feed. He calls that place that many of us are too familiar with these days. He calls this place the tragic gap. The tragic gap is the distance between the hard realities around us and what we know is possible. Not because we wish it were so, but because we have seen it with our own eyes. A lot of times I think of church as the place where we go to deal with the tragic gap. We come together to gather up the strength and the courage to live in the gap, to learn how to resist the equally alluring pulls of denial or despair. We come to stay awake in the mix of beauty and brokenness, and to gather up the strength and the support to do our part to keep making that gap just a little smaller. But sometimes church is the gap. It can be devastating when the distance shows up in church because we so want this to be the exception. We so want this here to here and us to have no gap. But the church is ultimately, it turns out, still a human institution filled with humans, sometimes short-sighted, sometimes petty, often self-centered humans. And so sometimes there will be a gap, sometimes a big one. Now, I knew all of this the Sunday that I was driving home from a long weekend of ministry. It was my first solo ministry, but it was not my first experience in church. Church had broken my heart at least two or three times already. But this was the first time it had happened as a minister. I was serving a congregation 3 hours from my home, so I would go and stay for 3 or 4 days at a time. We'd pack all the meetings, pastoral visits, the trainings, classes, and also worship all within 4 days or so. And then I'd go home and then come back a couple weeks later, and we'd do it again. So on this particular trip, I don't know, it was maybe 12 months, 18 months or so into my time with them. And so I knew them better, maybe, or they knew me better. But the stories that I was hearing there was a level of grief and anger and pain in their lives that I found overwhelming. But I could have handled that. That felt expected, like a privilege. What did it actually was the way they were treating each other, these congregants of mine, and the way they were sometimes treating me, which I have to say was terribly passive-aggressive and sometimes just aggressive. I had so much to offer. I was, you know, in my first year of ministry, I was eager and earnest. I had so much I wanted to give, and they were so afraid. And the sacrifices my family was making so I could do this, I mean, my kids were really young. They were 2.5 and an infant. And I was often, as you heard, away. And I wondered, why? How does anyone, why would anyone do this for their whole lives? How could I do it without just becoming sad and muttering miserable things pretty much all the time? I cried off and on the whole 3-hour drive home. As I got closer to town, I realized that I couldn't actually go home yet. I needed instead to make a phone call. They were marked in my favorites, so don't worry, as I was barreling down I-70, I just had one button to push. It was before the whole, like, you know, interface thing where you can now just tell your phone who to call. I had to push the button. So she said, "Hello," the Reverend Nancy Bowen answered. It could have easily been her husband, the Reverend Howell Lynn. "Can I come over?" I asked. Howell was the interim minister here at Foothills from 2015 to 16, so some of you know Howell. And Nancy served as the regional lead for the Pacific Western region of the Unitarian Universalist Association for a little over a decade before she retired in 2016, so you may also know her. Howell has been a Unitarian Universalist minister for going on 50 years. And Nancy has been a minister for half that time, but active as a lay leader for the whole of her life. But more important than any of this was that for more than a decade now, they have been my teachers, my friends, and my mentors. And in that moment, I was absolutely clear that I had to see them. We sat in their living room. There may have been scotch. I didn't tell them that much about what had happened in the preceding 4 days. It didn't even seem necessary. I only asked them with all sincerity and earnestness, how had they kept going? For all the years, I mean, surely they'd seen way worse, felt way worse, but from what I could tell, they were only occasionally overly cynical or sad, only occasionally muttering those miserable things. So what gave them the courage, I wondered, the strength? What allowed them to keep alive that bright thread of hope? And without hesitation, they both said, "You." By which they did not actually mean me. Not precisely more, they meant people like me, relationships like ours. Being able to mentor and support new ministers, they said, and to see the ways that these new ministers would, with their own passion and creativity, become leaders themselves. It wasn't, it turned out, just for the mentees' benefit. It was the thing that kept the fire alive in them. They recalled a recent time when they were listening to new ministers preaching on evil. And they said after hearing that, they realized, wow, even now we can keep going. Which I know is funny. It was on evil, after all. But they said they could hear there that our story was in good hands. The fire, the light, it would keep going. They told me then also about their own mentors, the women and men who had asked more of them than they thought possible, who'd pushed them and challenged them, showed up for them, and invited them to truly join in, and to whom they in turn felt responsible for passing it on. As they were talking, I understood suddenly what it is we mean when we say that Unitarian Universalism is a living tradition. We usually talk about it as if it's about knowledge, you know, about truth continuing to be revealed, not to close the book on truth. It's a living tradition. But in that moment, I realized that actually, the fact that our faith is a living tradition means that our faith has been created and recreated, sustained and supported, not through some apostolic line of passing down orthodoxy or through some policing of well-practiced rituals, but instead this, all of this, this bright thread of hope that we sustain here, that we embody here. All of this has been made possible and keeps being made possible by way of a great network of people who simply care about each other, a tender willingness of human beings, regular and flawed though we may be, receiving the blessing and then offering that same blessing to others, stoking that fire with their life, and then passing it on. In the fall of 2016, a small group of lay leaders, plus Eleanor Van Dusen, our director of faith formation, and then Sean and I, we all attended a workshop on the future of faith formation. And if that phrase doesn't make any sense to you, try out instead the future of how we will help people connect to and then feel responsible for the bright thread of hope. how we will help people connect to it, but then also feel responsible to the bright thread of hope. For shorthand, I'm just going to say the future of faith formation, but you can say that in your heads. The workshop gave us many good insights that we've been working to implement, but the major takeaway about faith formation from that time still challenges me because it is pretty radically different than how we've thought about our programs and about the whole way that we do church. Because it turns out that what truly forms people in faith, what makes people literally change their lives because they feel so responsible for stoking that fire of hope, it has nothing to do with offering great classes. Sorry, Matt. They can be great classes, but that's not what does it. It doesn't even have that much to do with really good sermons or great music, great as y'all may be, choir. It doesn't even have that much to do with helping people serve, even if it is meaningful service. These are all good entry points. They can get people started. They can help you stay connected. But the real way that the story of hope remains alive in any of us and in a way that can keep it alive in the world is exactly what I realized that day in Nancy and Howell's living room. It happens because someone who already feels responsible for this faith, this story, this courageous love, someone who feels responsible forms a real relationship with someone who doesn't yet, and then invests in them. Invests in a real relationship, a friendship, and then invites them to join in. It happens through friends. Friends that then become mentors, that then become partners, and then partners who pass it on. Mentorship is an ancient practice. The word mentor itself is inspired by the character Mentor in Homer's Odyssey, because, as I'm sure you'll all remember, you would never have to Google it the way that I did. In this story, the Odyssey, the goddess Athena takes on the appearance of the character Mentor in order to guide Telemachus in a time of difficulty. Thus, we now understand this idea of mentor as someone who offers guidance in times of difficulty. Now, despite these ancient roots, the concept of mentorship only recently became a thing that society talked about. Before the 1970s, people hadn't really heard or thought about mentoring per se, but by the 90s, finding a mentor seemed to be a critical part of the career-building process. With that said, any mentorship that's primarily serving a utilitarian purpose is not exactly mentorship, because mentoring isn't about gaining access or information or even about uploading skills, although these could be a byproduct. Mentorship is about relationship. It is a relationship of accountability and shared learning, and most of all, it is a relationship grounded in love. Mentorship is an investment in another person's personhood and potential, so much so that there's always the hope that the mentee will move the story forward in ways that the mentor could not. It is a relationship of mutual learning, a process of exploration and discovery, passing the blessing on, receiving it back, and repeating again. Sitting in that faith formation workshop together, the group of us started to wonder what it would mean if every elder in the church started to think of themselves as a mentor. And by elder, I don't mean older aged necessarily. We have some youth that I'd consider elders. And some of you 80-somethings, you are indeed novices. Now, I know last week Sean did the survey about who was an introvert. I'm not going to do that about this question of elder, because I already know that not enough hands would go up. So I'm just going to let you know up front that you're wrong. Many of you are elders. Many of you have things to teach and to pass on. Most of you, actually. So we were sitting there with this vision of how transformational it would be if every person who was an elder, that is, every person who had a sense of responsibility for this congregation or this faith, sense of commitment to that story of hope and our mission of courageous love, if all of these folks were charged not with simply continuing there, I mean, you, your discrete responsibilities in the congregation, or even charged with finding someone who they could train to do those discrete responsibilities. But instead, we started to imagine that these elders, most of you, were charged with creating the kinds of relationship with others, the others of you, where we would be inviting and challenging them, discovering and exploring with them their emerging commitment to this story of hope, and listening for what new story we might create together. So that all of us, as we receive this blessing, also simultaneously start to feel an expectation, a responsibility to pass it on. For this is the way the fire keeps burning. In turn, we imagine that as folks arrive here seeking a sense of belonging or meaning, we would help them not just find the program or the class they might be interested in, or even the service they can plug into, but more start to imagine who are the people that they should meet. Like, who are the people that could become their companions, who would invest in their personhood, their becoming, the people who would, before too long, invite them to share in leadership. The authors of the book Growing Young call this vision of ongoing mentorship, they call it keychain leadership, because it's advocating handing over the keys to that next generation of leaders, but not in a way that's like empowerment by way of abandonment. Here you go, good luck. But more as a matter of accompaniment, where we walk alongside those who are just beginning, who are trying to find their way, sharing our lessons, even while we simultaneously hand over access, influence, and responsibility, the two go together. There is something counterintuitive at the heart of this mentorship-based or keychain-based leadership paradigm of faith formation, because today in our overly busy world, we don't want to ask too much of anyone, or else we might scare them away. So we try to make participation easy, simple, afraid that we might otherwise become just one more thing on the too full to-do list. But what we are learning is that when we ground the invitation in relationship, place it in the context of ongoing support and care, and that investment in personhood, and then in the bigger mission, in the story of hope, and the unleashing of courageous love, then people are eager to join in, and to be a part, and to keep passing it on. I had the chance to spend some time with Victoria Safford last February. She's the author of our reading today. She's the minister of a congregation just a little bigger than ours outside the Twin Cities, and I wish I could say she was one of my mentors. But I have admired her ministry for a long time, which is why I was surprised when I finally got to talk to her in person, that when I asked her about her church and her vision, I was sort of looking for a notion of inspiration and beauty. I asked her what was on her mind, and she said one word, vigilance. Not compassion or justice, hope, vigilance. We must be vigilant, she said. Our story is always at risk. Our bright thread of hope is always at risk. We cannot take it for granted. We must be vigilant. On a week like this, when the gap feels so big, I know exactly what she means. We need more partners. More partners who are invested more deeply, more keepers of the story, more tenders of the flame. More who will help us keep watch, that we might keep hope, stoking this story of courageous love with our lives, that we might keep passing it on. May it be so.